Listen to RN On Demand anytime or download your favourite programs from RN Online.
Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart. A very warm welcome to Books and Arts here on RN. Today, we run away to the circus to hear about a masterclass for Indigenous performers.
Circus encourages us just to really hit those marks and, yeah, really exaggerate our talent. And when you put that with culture, it really hits out.
Sounds like they're having a great time, doesn't it? That's a masterclass at Circus Oz. And you'll meet Brian Dorries, the man who performs ancient Greek plays to modern-day soldiers. Brian himself has known tragedy in his life.
All of a sudden, they spoke to me as if they'd been written about my experiences or for me to read or to hear. And I found relief in knowing that I wasn't the first person to have felt ambivalent in the presence of another person's suffering or about the kind of ethical decisions one faces around the end of life.
And that personal connection with the Greek tragedies led Brian to found his project, the Theatre of War. There's also some powerful war theatre playing in Sydney.
Five gunnery system ready to engage.
Light turbine noise, possible warship.
And a big splash at the end, drenching us all. That's a little bit of what you'll experience in a new exhibit called Action Stations. It's an immersive experience. Everything these days is an immersive experience. You can't put on a show without calling it immersive. It's just opened at the Australian National Maritime Museum in Sydney. And it's a project put together by Kevin Sumption, who is director of the museum. He's going to tell us about it. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Michael.
And helping to bring all this to life is Phil McKendrick, who was in the Navy for 20 years and served on one of the vessels in this exhibit, HMAS Vampire. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Michael.
Good to have you here. So what exactly is this, Kevin? Action Stations. What? It's a couple of ships, is it?
It's a little bit more than a couple of ships. It's really a theatre experience suspended above the water between a Cold War era submarine, HMAS Onslow, and a Cold War era destroyer, HMAS Vampire. And it uses some very cutting edge digital technologies really to try and recreate what it was like to be a sailor in the 1970s, in the middle of the Cold War, on board both of these vessels.
And now, I still haven't quite got this. I mean, we should just explain to people at the Maritime Museum, you've got actual ships. You come into a building and then you go out the back and there are ships and you can crawl all over them. It's fantastic. So when you say it's suspended above them, you mean, is the audience up there or is there screens? What are we looking at?
Well, there is a wharf between the two warships, and I should say these two warships are the largest objects in the national collection. So the submarine, HMAS Onslow, is just under 90 metres, and of course you can go on board the submarine and you can go on board our destroyer. But it's a beautiful building designed by one of Australia's premier architects, Richard Francis Jones from FJMT, and he's built what really is a third vessel, you might say, that sits between the two ships, and it provides a cinema experience to take you back to the 1970s on board these vessels going to action stations. And then there are a series of exhibits that kind of prepare you before you go on board the submarine and go on board the destroyer.
And how did you go about creating this exhibit? Was there something that inspired you to do this?
I suppose it was my luck, really. Going back to 2009, I was in Genoa, and they have a beautiful maritime museum in Genoa. And in 2009, they took delivery of a decommissioned Italian submarine. And I was over there at the time the submarine was brought alongside the museum. And we had some very, very interesting conversations about how do you bring to life a vessel that effectively the crew has now disappeared, the crew an integral part of running this. And at that time, we started talking about developing a multimedia experience for that submarine in Genoa. That kind of happened in a very small scale in Genoa. And really, 3 years ago, the opportunity came for us to do something more substantial, not just with a submarine, but also with a destroyer.
We talk so much about soldiers when we think about military service. The Navy, you know, is a kind of forgotten force, it seems to me, especially in regards to the Second World War, because the Navy was such an important part of the Second World War story, and we tell it so rarely. Is that part of your motive here?
It is. It's important to remember not even just the Second World War, but also the First World War. The service of the Royal Australian Navy was essential in the forces. And you're right, Michael, it's fair to say that it's a story that's not particularly well known. And this pavilion that we've built, the Action Stations Pavilion, also looks particularly at the service in the First World War and things like our submarine AE-2, which was an integral part of the Gallipoli campaign. But again, a story not particularly well known. And that wreck sits in the bottom of the Sea of Marmara in 70 metres of water and is being looked after by the Turkish Navy and by the Australian National Maritime Museum.
So what do people tell you when they come away from this exhibit we're discussing this morning? I gather it's been up and running for a couple of weeks now.
I think the key thing is, as we're a museum, we are first and foremost about learning. And so the exhibit has been put together very carefully so that people can understand not only what the Royal Australian Navy did in the Cold War era, but as well as looking back, we look forward. And a very important question we posed when we set about building this experience was we wanted people to understand why we have a Navy here in Australia. And the kind of feedback we're now getting, we'll do some formal research in coming months, but we're kind of getting the responses that we wanted. People are understanding the importance of having a Navy, and that's some of the future kind of storytelling that we do in this experience, as well as looking backwards through the history of the Royal Australian Navy.
So, Phil McKendrick, you were in the Navy from 1971 through to 1991, so 20 years, and I gather you've made quite a contribution to this exhibit. You were only 16 when you joined the Navy. What drew you to do that?
I was a junior recruit. I got into the Navy at 16 when they used to have junior recruits. They don't have them anymore. But my passion was the ocean. I wanted to go to sea. Another close passion of mine was steam engines. And the Navy fitted both because the ships that we served on during my period were steam operated vessels, and Vampire was one of them.
Yeah, but there are other ways of going to sea. You don't have to join the Navy. I mean, about Navy life? Because, to put it bluntly, you can get killed in the Navy and you have to kill people if you end up in active service. Whereas if you went to sea some other way, you wouldn't have that aspect as well. Was there something about military service that appealed to you as well?
Well, I think, if you look back at the history of the Navy, there was also merchant ships. Merchant ships played an important part both in World War I and World War II, and they were seconded to be part of the Navy. A good example is Japaret, that was seconded to go to Vietnam as a transport vessel. I was fortunate in that regards that I wanted the Navy because I enjoyed the discipline. I came from a very structured family. Two of my brothers were in the Army. They had served in Vietnam. So that sort of drew me to the forces.
And what sort of jobs have you done over those 20 years?
Oh, wow. Well, I was a marine engineer, trained at HMAS Cerberus down in Melbourne once I finished my junior recruit training, which when I joined the Navy, I thought I was going to sea, but I actually went back to school for 12 months, and they taught me over in Western Australia about the Navy and about navigation, about seamanship, how to tie knots, and then they sent me to sea. So that was a little bit of a disappointment. But a marine engineer does all facets of operating a vessel at sea, from operating boilers, main engines, evaporators that make the water for the ship's company to drink, diesel generators that generate the power for the ships, and also maintain the vessels whilst alongside.
And do people in the Navy today still learn to tie knots? It seems like such a sort of ancient craft. Here we are in the modern computer-driven world and we're still learning how to do a bowline.
Yeah, look, yeah, they do. The basic training for a sailor today is really no different to what we had back in the 70s. they go to Cerberus or down in Melbourne and they do their basic recruit training. And that takes them through the basics, I suppose. And a part of that is physical training. Part of that's learning how to tie knots, learning how to be at sea. And yes, you still have to tie knots when you're at sea because somehow the ship's got to be tied up.
Yeah. On our, yeah, that makes sense. On RN, this is Books and Arts, and we're hearing all about Action Stations, which is a new exhibit at the Australian National Maritime Museum at Darling Harbour in Sydney. Kevin Sumption runs the museum, and Phil McKendrick is with us. He served in the Navy for 20 years, and he's helped put all this together. So here's a couple of excerpts from some of the stories that are represented in Action Stations.
Everyone's aware of danger at sea because it is such a dangerous environment, especially when you put the sea state into it. And I think that's why we train so much, so that people do know what to expect if something does happen.
As a 22, 23-year-old, I was in charge of the electrical and hydraulic maintenance of the gun turrets on the Vampire. But, of course, it's boys that fight wars, and, you know, average age on the Vampire, of, you know, it was probably about 24. There we were, all feeling overtly confident about what we were doing, and I think many of us, though, were quaking inside. We were just bluffing. Well, I certainly was.
How big a factor do you reckon that is? Do you think that fear, Phil, plays a part in what's going on? Were you afraid ever?
Yeah, look, there was times where we were very afraid, but the ship pulled together, and that's what a ship does to you. You make friends and mates, and you look after each other. And it's no different in today's Navy. Even now, they have female officers and female sailors going to sea, and there's no difference. There's camaraderie on board a ship. But yeah, look, you do feel a sense of fear. I was 18 when we were seconded Vampire. HMS Vampire was seconded to meet with our troop carrier Sydney and enter into hostile waters. We went to Vung Tau. We were the last destroyer that went into Vung Tau, and we were extracting our troops, and that was during the withdrawal phase. Yeah, look, we were in harbour, unfriendly waters. We weren't sure what was really, if anything was going to happen. We felt that sort of afraid that we steamed out at night. We didn't stay in harbour at night time. It was too dangerous. So we'd steam out at night and then we'd come back in the next day. And the first lady that spoke about the sea state, we hit some horrific weather on Vampire, but she was well built. She's an English designed ship, but the three ships were built in Australia. That was Vampire, Voyager and Vendetta. Unfortunately, Voyager was lost in 64. That's another danger, collision at sea. I was involved in a collision with a Royal Fleet auxiliary tanker. And, yeah, I was down the boiler room at the time. And that's frightening because you really don't have windows. You don't know what's going on outside you because the ship's closed up. And Action Stations is another state where you get into when there's an imminent threat.
I've often thought about this. I mean, if you come under fire and you're down in the boiler room, you're not going to survive, are you? I mean, other people are going to get out, but the guys who are down there running the machinery, they're going to
Yeah, look, if the ship's lost, there are ways of getting out. There are escape hatches, and if you look through the history of World War One, World War Two, a lot of ships were sunk with all lives lost, Perth being one, as well as the some survived. So your chance of survival, whilst limited, you always had it in your mind that you would survive.
Yeah. Kevin Sumption, you run the museum. When I first heard about this exhibition, part of me was a bit cautious about it all, to be honest with you. My father was a gunner on a destroyer called a Runter, and he was there in the Battle of the Surigoa Strait in October 1944, and I don't think he ever recovered from the rage and the horror of that experience. And I wonder whether any simulation can give you a sense of the imminence of death, with men on both sides being killed and the notion that you could be killed. You know, I wonder about a museum that makes it look like a kind of adventure when the reality of war, that ultimately death is what is at stake here, that can't be created in a museum.
I think that's a really good point, Michael, because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is give you a sense of what it was like to serve on board a warship, particularly when the people are absent. So we have a submarine that had a crew of 66, and HMAS Vampire, which Phil was on, had a crew of 320. And as you encounter these vessels, of course, you're just a visitor, and it's almost a stage set that has been vacated. So part of the design challenge for us is very, very sensitively talking to sailors who have served, and very closely and very collaboratively constructing experiences, not just kind of intellectual experiences, but also emotional experiences that give you not just a sense of being at action stations, but there are important emotions like if you're a sailor and you're away on a tour of duty, you're removed from your family for months and months at end. And yes, you have the camaraderie of the people around you, but you have the absence of family. So these were some of the real design challenges that, yes, you're right, we don't want a caricature. We don't want to kind of have a parody. How do we bring to life? And primarily we've done that by looking at real experiences and talking to people like Phil and many other people who've served on board. And their first-hand experiences are available all through the Action Stations exhibit. And they, you know, they are stories. There are sailors talking about loss. There's sailors talking about family. There's sailors talking about, as Phil just said, being afraid. So as well as using new technologies to kind of bring to life the command structure of going to action stations, we've also very carefully brought to life nearly 100 stories, personal testimonies, that talk about the challenges of working on a warship and what it's like to be a human being facing adversity and facing battle.
And Kevin, how did you go about gathering that oral history in a situation where people felt empowered or trusting enough to be candid with you?
I think we started first and foremost with people like Phil, who'd been associated with the museum professionally and as a volunteer and other things for very, very many years. For instance, HMS Vampire at the museum, we have still to this day 20 to 30 servicemen who look after that vessel for us. So they are the first people we would talk to about bringing their particular experiences of serving on board to life. And then the Navy itself has been an enormous collaborator. So the Royal Australian Navy has been providing, for instance, when we actually did the documentaries for Action Stations, we used serving sailors to reenact what going to action stations in the 1970s was like. So we only had one actor in 60. So it gives you a sense of the collaboration that we had with the Navy. And, of course, the Navy has its own heritage centre and its own collection, as do we, and many, many experts in the field of Royal Australian Navy history have helped put together a very authentic learning experience, which I think is also very sensitive to the real-life experience of serving on board one of the Royal Australian Navy's warships.
Well, I look forward to coming to visit you next time I'm in Sydney. Thank you to the two of you for coming in. It's been great to talk.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Kevin Sumption is the CEO and Director of the Australian Maritime Museum, and Phil McKendrick served with the Royal Australian Navy from 1971 through to 91, and Action Stations is a new permanent exhibition at the museum. You'll find it at Darling Harbour in Sydney. And it's fascinating. If you've never been there, pop along and have a look, because there's so much to look at. We'll have more details, and there are some pictures too, on our website, the Books and Arts website. This is Books and Arts on RN. Now to the theatre of war as it's playing out in America.
This year's El Niño event could be one of the biggest on record.
This summer, as the heat sets in and we bunker down for mango madness, we want your stories of landscape change in words and pictures. From the pot plant to the paddock, stories from a big landscape. It'll be your summer diary online. There's a tips and tricks page to get you started. Just look for Hot Summer Land on the RN homepage.
Ajax. Ajax. My name is a sad song. Who would have thought it would someday become the sound a man makes in despair?
the actor Bill Camp performing an excerpt from the play Ajax by Sophocles. Now, that play was written around 450 BC. That's nearly 2,500 years ago. And it's the story of Ajax, a powerful and blooded soldier who is worked up into homicidal fury against his own comrades and commanders after they insult him. And it ends with Ajax killing himself, literally falling on his own sword. American writer and director Brian Dorries says that's a story which modern soldiers relate to. They know Ajax. And he's been presenting highly charged readings of this and other Greek tragedies to serving American soldiers, all in the name of confronting the trauma and the mental suffering, which for so many is the price of war service. And he's written about his experiences in a compelling new book called The Theatre of War. And he joins us now from a studio in New York City. Brian, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So this is the Theatre of War project. How does it work? You present readings, do you?
Yes. I mean, I call them readings on steroids because the actors bring all of their talents to bear. They rip through their vocal cords. The spit and tears are flying from the stage. And it's not like a reading that one would normally see in a commercial theater.
No, it wouldn't be polite. But, I mean, New York actors anyway read like mad people. I've been to New York readings, and there's a kind of urgency and power that I don't think you can get in rehearsal rooms anywhere else in the world. So when did you realize that these works from 2,500 years ago, had the capacity to affect, to heal communities in the way that you say they do?
It was very much a personal journey for me. I had studied these plays as a student of classics. I studied Greek and Latin in school and had translated some of them and even directed a few of them. And I thought I knew what they were about. In my early to mid-20s, I fell in love and I lost my girlfriend who died of cystic fibrosis in 2003. She was 22 and I was 26. And the experience of caring for her and witnessing her suffering and being present when she died changed my relationship to these tragedies. All of a sudden, they spoke to me as if they'd been written about my experiences or for me to read or to hear. And I found relief in knowing that I wasn't the first person to have felt ambivalent in the presence of another person's suffering or about being a caregiver or about the kind of ethical decisions one faces around the end of life. And so I got this idea in my head, if I could simply put these ancient Greek plays in front of audiences who'd lived the experiences they describe, something powerful and healing might happen. And I started in hospitals. I got my first sort of reading of this nature in a hospital in New York City. And when I heard the medical students and doctors and even patients responding to Sophocles' plays, a veil was lifted. All of a sudden I saw something that's informed my work ever since, which is that the audience knew more than I did.
Well, if you can rescue these plays from being classics and rediscover the ways in which they are contemporary, something very powerful happens. So you've managed to persuade some very well-known actors to perform in the Theatre of War project that you've been doing. Just tell us some of the people who are on board with you.
Everyone from Jake Gyllenhaal, Frances McDormand, Paul Giamatti, Martin Sheen, Terrence Howard. Over in the UK, Jason Isaacs, the list goes on and on and on of very committed actors with social conscience who jump at the opportunity to do something that feels as if it's of service with their work. It's very rare in our profession to feel like we're doing anything for anyone other than ourselves, but to feel like your craft is actually moving the needle and making a difference, perhaps even saving lives. It's such a rare experience that we've had now close to 200 actors all sign up and participate.
Yeah. Let's paint a picture. You've got a hall and on the stage there are these actors and they're not wearing togas and whatnot. It's a reading. Tell us about the performance you staged for Marines in the Hyatt Ballroom in San Diego, because that was a particularly highly charged night.
Yeah, that was the first performance of Theatre of War for a military audience. It was in August of 2008. I had somehow found my way into the Marine Corps after a year of trying to convince someone that this was something we should do. And I brought actors David Strathairn and Jesse Eisenberg and Bill Camp, who you already heard. And we read six scenes from two plays by Sophocles, Ajax and Philoctetes. Ajax is the story of a great warrior who comes unraveled in the ninth year of the Trojan War after losing his best friend and after being betrayed by his command. And in an act of blind rage, he tries to kill his commanding officers and he fails, kills animals instead in a berserk state. And when he wakes up and sees what he's done, covered in blood and shame, he ends his own life, and the play stages his suicide. I mean, his suicide happens on stage, and it's very powerful for contemporary military audiences to hear. The other play, Philoctetes, is about a veteran who's abandoned on an island by his own men on account of his chronic illness, something he contracts on the way to the Trojan War. And it's about the isolation of living on that island and being completely cut off from humanity. He's bitten by a snake, and his wound is described as a wound that never heals. And that becomes a metaphor that, you know, many of our service members respond to and connect with. So we performed these six scenes from these two plays for 400 Marines and their spouses. We scheduled a 45-minute discussion after the reading, and the discussion lasted 3.5 hours and had to be cut off close to midnight. And what people did was, much to my delight and surprise, they stood up and they quoted lines from memory from Sophocles' plays as if they'd known the plays their entire lives. And they related those lines to their own personal experiences, things they'd never shared in private, let alone in front of 400 of their peers. And they took the risk of meeting the material. The material is very powerful, and it describes, you know, really extreme emotions. And in some way, the play and the performance is saying to the audience, we're going to go this far. And if you want to meet us halfway, you can. And that's what people did. They met us halfway, and they cried, and they shared stories. And it was then that I discovered that we had stumbled across a very powerful ancient technology that had the power to deliver an experience that's very much missing and very much needed in our highly secularized and mediated world.
On Books and Arts, you're listening to Michael Cathcart talking to Brian Dorries, who is an American theatre maker who runs a project called The Theatre of War, and they take plays, tragedies, particularly Ajax is the one we've been talking about particularly, and perform them for American service personnel and their families, people who've looked into the eye of the tiger in war and known the terrible challenges that war presents, and found that their own experiences are reflected in these plays that were written over 2,000 years ago. Brian, you tell the story of a woman who said, "My husband, who is a Navy SEAL, so an elite serviceman, my husband went away 4 times to war, and each time he returned like Ajax, dragging invisible bodies into our house." And to quote the play, she said, "Our home is a slaughterhouse."
Yeah, she was the first to speak, one of the first people to speak at a theater of war performance. Her name was Marshall. And what she did was model for other audience members how to respond. And also, to me, just opened up limitless possibilities for what we could do with this material. That she saw her husband's experience and her own experience. She said, "The war came home with my husband, just like it came home with Ajax." And when she did that, other spouses in the audience then followed her lead.
There wasn't universal acclaim that night. The general's wives who were in the audience were furious at what was happening.
They were, but I went out and... Well, so what happened briefly is that one of the first people to speak after Marshall was a nun, a Canadian chaplain, who'd served men from 40 years of service as a chaplain. And she approached the microphone, a little piece of paper in her hand, and she read from her notes. And she said, "I, in front of this audience of 400 Marines, I want to quote a line from Ajax that I've heard countless young men say to me in my 4 decades of service to the Canadian Army." And she said, she read, "Witness how the generals have destroyed me," which is one of Ajax's lines. And before she could finish that, her following statements, one of the general's wives who was seated in the front row jumped up and attacked the nun. "How dare you say that," she said. "You know, our husbands have made this possible. This is about healing, this discussion. It's not about what divides us." And before I knew it, there were 30 people lined up to participate in the conversation who were all taking the risk of kind of addressing each other in this highly charged way. But there was something about the plays that kept even the most heightened and emotional exchanges within certain boundaries. I think once an audience has been exposed to human suffering, to a portrayal of human suffering, what would in any other context result in a shouting match always returns to a sort of core human response of empathy and compassion. And so many connections were made that night. And even the general's wife who attacked the nun afterwards, when I approached her to make sure she was all right, said that she really appreciated the event and asked me if I had thought about joining the Marine Corps. And I told her, no, I was fine just directing plays.
stay with your day job, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, as you tell the story, various senior people in the military are impressed by what you do, both people who deal with mental health issues, but also generals. And gradually they facilitate events where you speak to enormous numbers sometimes of servicemen.
Yeah.
And you've got so many stories like this. And you write a lot about trauma and about depression and suicide, about this deep cost of war, this deep internal unseen cost, well, unseen by the world, but known only too well by the women usually who share their lives with these men who come back so broken, and of course women too who've done service. But you also say something very interesting. Quite late in the book you say the majority of people who spoke after these performances said that they had been made stronger Mm-hmm. by their war-related experiences and expressed a deep appreciation of life and its fragility. And that was such an unexpected observation in the flow of your book. I wondered whether you could enlarge on that kind of response to war service.
Yeah, I think it's easy for us to slip into a kind of stereotypical perception of the military as broken and weak, those people who've been to war. But these young men and women who go to war, they confront life and death. They lose close friends. They suffer catastrophic injuries. They face incredible horror, and they see things that upend their moral universe, their sense of right and wrong. People, you know, young women strapping on suicide vests, and families being killed in the collateral damage of military actions that probably are according to protocol. And you know, all of these things produce people who are incredibly resilient and have a tremendous amount to teach us, those of us who haven't been to war. And in the United States, less than 0.5% of our population has served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And there's a tremendous divide between those who have served and those who haven't. And so we want to raise awareness about our moral and ethical obligation to help those who've served heal. No matter what our opinions are of the war or the foreign policy that sent us to war, what we as a democracy owe to those who've served and how do we help them? And so the plays are about raising that awareness when we do them in public spaces. But I also want to say, and I said in the book as forcefully as I could, I've met some of the strongest, most resilient, most impressive people all through this project, in the military in particular, all of whom have a heightened and nuanced and profound understanding and appreciation for human life and for the fragility of our existence. And it's that wisdom, that insight that's born from the crucible of war that makes them such fascinating and powerful audience members, which makes me always come back to them with the humility and the knowledge that they know more than I do about the plays we perform.
You cite a psychiatrist named Dr. Jonathan Shea, who's on the same kind of wavelength as you are and who's worked with Vietnam vets. He has a theory about the origins of Greek tragedy.
So Jonathan Shea is this amazing synthetic thinker who crosses all these disciplines. He's won the MacArthur Genius Award here in the United States. It's one of our coveted cultural awards. And he wrote a book called Achilles in Vietnam and another book called Odysseus in America, where he argues that storytelling in the Western world, maybe in the world in general, was born from the need to hear and tell the veteran story, that the Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, are about veterans and war, not coincidentally, but out of necessity, that the narration and the telling of the experience of war is critical and essential for the communalization, as he says, of that experience, that we all share in it, whether we went to it or not. And he thinks that Greek tragedy in particular was a way of this highly militarized democracy in Athens, which saw nearly 80 years of war in a 100-year period. It was a way for them to bring the city together. I mean, one-third of the population of the city would have been of the citizens in the city would have been sitting in that theater in spring of the year that those plays were performed, bearing witness to the truth of the experience of war, not in isolation, but as a community. And so seen through that lens, ancient Greek tragedy appears as a really remarkable method of bringing people together and helping them to connect and to collectively shoulder the pollution, as is said in the Greek, the miasma that comes back from war together.
You could read the Iliad and the Odyssey, which come out of an older tradition, in the same way, surely. you know, it's possible to read the Iliad as a kind of swashbuckling tale of derring do, but a close reading of the Iliad surely leaves you with a kind of yin and yang view of war, with, you know, the terrible, terrible price that war exacts on people, as well as the sort of glory and the valour.
No question. I mean, the Odyssey is a story about a combat veteran who's returning from the Trojan War, and it takes him 10 years to return, and you don't have to look very far for metaphors that are completely, you know, mapped to our world today.
Yeah. Oh, well, the biggest metaphor is he's lost his way and can't find his way home.
Exactly. That's the central metaphor, that it's possible to be home and not recognize it, which is what happens when he lands on the beaches of Ithaca after those 10 years, to not even not even recognize the soil of your own homeland after going to war.
Brian, as we wind up, where does this leave you in your own views about the function of war, about the use of military force to achieve desirable ends?
Well, look, I marched against the invasion of Iraq in the United States. I felt it was a huge foreign policy mistake. It wasn't until the Walter Reed scandal broke. That was when, in 2007, the Washington Post released an article exposing that our nation's largest military hospital, Army hospital, was under-resourced. People were coming back from these wars, and they weren't being treated to the medical treatment they deserve, both physical and mental. And that was when I got started with theater of war. My position is that there is no greater condemnation of war and of its horror, no more powerful condemnation than people who've been to war speaking honestly and openly about it. But if you're looking for a way to celebrate those very rare and important and crucial values that we've lost for the most part in our secular society that still live in some ways in the military, a sense of honor, of duty, of fidelity, an appreciation for the fragility of human life, then you can also look to these stories. And so the plays aren't meant to be political, but the objective of what we do is to bring people together and say, well, what is our moral obligation? How do we help people who've been to the conflicts begin to heal? And I hope this is also how forward-thinking democracies, you know, we're standing at a very critical moment where it looks like the world may be summoning all of us back to war again, how we weigh and discuss and think about the human costs of those decisions. And it's in the stories of the people who've experienced them, I think, that we should find the wisdom to guide our decisions, you know, in the weeks and months to come.
Brian, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Brian Dorries is a writer, director, and translator. He's the founder of Theatre of War, a project that presents readings of ancient Greek tragedies to returned servicemen and women to help them, well, come to terms, I guess, with the experiences they've been through. And his new book is wonderful. It's called The Theatre of War. It's published in Australia by Scribe. I loved reading it. It's a profound encounter, and I really recommend it. On air, online, and on your ABC radio app, you're with RN. This is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart. Yes, crazy stuff. That's from Circus Oz's latest show, but wait, there's more. Well, while the performers are rehearsing that show for their upcoming Sydney tour, there's another program happening at Circus Oz's headquarters in Melbourne. The 10 Indigenous performers from across Australia have come together for a circus masterclass. They're part of Circus Oz's Black Flip program. Nice pun there, Black Flip. And it's for Indigenous performers. They get 3 weeks of intensive training in tumbling and acrobatics and clowning. So let's go there now. Georgia Moody takes us there to Circus Oz to learn more about the Black Flip program for Indigenous circus performers.
Hi, my name's Shirley Hood, Nyungar Kurnai Gunditj Damara. And I love stand-up comedy and clowning. Mix it with circus, you've got a great run. Kudu.
My name's Lara Croydon. I am Gajala Kaboba and Kuku Yalanji. I came from theatre and have been training circus for the past 2.5 years-ish.
My name's Guy Simon. I'm Birrapai Waramai man, and I'm an actor.
Lara, maybe we'll start with you as the newbie. This is your first time doing Black Flip. What's been some of the highlights of the past 2.5 weeks here?
All of it. It's been really awesome. We've got a really, really good group of people together, so it's really nice to have kind of people that have been here heaps of times before and then a fair few people who are brand new, like me. So the group's really, really kind of come together and really supportive of each other, no matter kind of the level that we've come with. But the other great thing is that everybody in the group seems to have come with their own specialty of some description, and they're not necessarily shared. So there is kind of your own chance to be the teacher and to be the student at different times, which is really nice.
What's the best thing you've learnt so far?
I've been working on trapeze, which I usually do, but I'm actually most proud that I broke my finger before I came here, so I couldn't do any tumbling and still can't. But so when everyone else was doing tumbling, I was sitting off to the side trying to learn to juggle, and I can now juggle, which I'm pretty proud of. Only three balls, I'm getting there for the rest.
Shirley, you've done black flip before. What do you get out of this masterclass?
Yeah, well, I've been flipped out a couple of times. It's great being a part of Black Flip. I didn't think I'd actually be this excited about getting into circus, just having the different background. But I've found that circus incorporates all the different artistic parts of me, and it allows me to be able to put it together, you know. So I've had a go like at having a look at like stand-up comedy, clowning. But this time as well, I've had a lot more looking at like acrobatics and tumbling and rolling, and I jumped up there on the trapeze for one shot, and it's been a really great thing of just getting back into shape at this point and really have a look at what you were capable of doing. Mm. Circus brings that out.
Guy, how about you? You've been to Black Flip before, so something's clearly brought you back.
Yeah, the first time that I did it was in 2012, and that I think it only lasts for a week. But this time around, I found it that it went longer, so that's what kind of drew me here. So I could, like Shirley was saying, you can stretch yourself as a performer, and you can incorporate these different skills. Like we both do comedy and stuff like that, and now we know how to put the physical part into it. So what drew me to the program is that the first time I was here, I developed a clowning character, but I didn't really get to kind of chomp into it. I just found it right at the end. So now I get to kind of play with it and for 3 weeks and try and find other ways of comedic performance through, you know, juggling or trapeze or flipping, and yeah, just trying to find different ways to become a more well-rounded performer.
So who's Guy the Clown?
Guy the Clown. There isn't a Guy the Clown. There's, well, the first character that I developed was a character called Rabbit, and he was a rabbit who couldn't jump. Didn't know how to jump. But the other day we just found a different character who was a kangaroo called Paco, and he's Latino and he's from a country called Latino. I'm just finding this character is just evolving now, and because I've had so long to develop this character, it's great.
Clearly there is a mix of cultural influences with the Latino character, but I was wondering how your Indigenous culture and storytelling traditions and humour feeds into your circus work.
Oh, well, absolutely. Having our culture as a part of us, I think we were, you know, in the genes, we've got all these dynamic talents with everybody, and being able just to exercise them, understand it, be able to work with people who are also talented and pushing for the best of themselves in this area together. It's a real safe place to have these weeks just to really test yourself and challenge and push yourself to the next level. I've really enjoyed, you know, being able to filter into our culture and how we pull that through and bring it out in circus, you know. A lot of dance and movement, I find, is really important, and sounds that we bring out. Circus encourages us just to really hit those marks and, yeah, really exaggerate our talent. And when you put that with culture, it really hits out.
For me too, it's that, you know, culturally story, it was never just told, it was also danced and it was sung and it was also the land. And so circus just seems to be another way to tell story, which we've all been doing for generations upon generations. So it's just a kind of new way to tell it to me.
Shirley, you're also a comedian. Is there a particular brand of Indigenous humour that comes out when you, when you're up on stage as a circus performer?
Yeah, I think that sort of, you know, I work really hard at making sure that culture comes through in stand-up comedy. It's really full-on sort of performance style where you go on as yourself, you know, times 100, and circus helps you understand that we've got this in us and how to pull that out. Because when you're dealing with, like, lots of people wanting to laugh, and as a professional thing, it can really be stressful and get to you, you know. But at least within circus, you learn how to have a bit more fun. We're around Aboriginal people at this time, and it is great just to have a good laugh between us while we're developing our talents, you know. But the main thing, it just keeps teaching me to breathe and to be able to understand when you're stepping out on stage or when you're performing that there's a lot more behind you than you think, you know. Apart from when you've got to do stand-up comedy, you know, it's great if you've got abs to go along with that. So I'm practicing getting those abs, eh?
Yeah. Circus Oz is known as a political circus. It's always been very vocal about land rights and reconciliation. Guy, is that one of the reasons why you wanted to be part of Circus Oz, because it's also political?
I guess it's the love and support for Indigenous culture here. You know, as soon as you walk in the building, there's a sign saying you're on this land, and there's always the respect for it and the sensitivity, you know, and, you know, you don't feel like there's anything pushing against you. It's just like, come in, you're more than welcome, I'll help you out. And you don't feel like you have a skin colour here, you know. Everyone's just the same. There's no room for ego here. Everyone's kind of in their own race, you know. How am I physically to get up on this? What are my limits? What are my strengths, type of thing? So you don't ever push against anyone else, and that's the kind of feel of the whole building, you know. It's welcome, come in. So that's the main reason, I guess, why I came in. I didn't really have any political drive to come here.
Yeah, even though I've seen a bit of Circus Oz, and I love that part of it. Circus Oz, in all of its shows, touch on different things, like whether it's, you know, the economic crisis that's going on in our country. Circus Oz has looked at these themes in their different shows, and I knew way back when I first saw that I would love to be a part of that team and just work in there and get out to the audience and get people thinking as well, you know, that there are different ways to bring up topics and conversations, you know, without having any straight sort of style about it. But within circus, you can educate as well as perform, as well as bring out the best in people and give the kids a great night as well, you know. Yeah, but I love Circus Oz for that, and I love the fact that we can just walk in. We're not a colour, we are a person, and we are somebody with a talent and a story to tell. So Circus Oz grabs that and really encourages us to be ourselves. So brrr to Circus Oz, congrats. There's so much that it gives to you, and I hope to start just getting our communities into circus. You know, I hope that our people will grab this knowledge and share it back with our communities. Mm. As I've seen over the couple of times I've been here, seeing the new ones come in and, by golly, knocking us out. We've got people there, you know, who can do, you know, forward somersaults, triple somersaults, you know, double backwards. It's like all this brilliant talent that you can see in young people, and this program, Blackflip, has really just encouraged us to continue that.
And just to let communities know that, and younger generations and older generations, if they see, because young Indigenous kids, they're so physically fit, and in their spare time they're doing backflips and everything. They haven't been trained. But to let them know and their parents know that they can make a career out of this, and that's I think that's the best thing about this program is that it lets them know that I can do something with my natural talent, you know, and start to hone it.
Guy Simon, one of the Indigenous performers taking part in Circus Oz's Black Flip Masterclass, speaking there with Georgia Moody. And we also heard from Lara Croydon and Shira Lee Hood, all having a great time, all working hard. Brrr to all of them. On RN, this is Books and Arts, where it's time now for Top Shelf. Now, yesterday you might have caught my conversation with the Irish writer Colm McCann. His new book, 13 Ways of Looking, is, I reckon, just about perfect as a collection of stories. For Top Shelf, Colm shares a few of his own favourite works.
I suppose my number one pick is the novel Ulysses by James Joyce. Ulysses, for me, is the novel that is the vast compendium of human experience. It seems to have everything in it. It's funny, it's raucous, it's bawdy, it's intellectual, it's confusing, full of wonderful lines like, love loves to love love. What other writer could get four loves in a five-word sentence? A wonderful book, and it would certainly be on my top shelf. My number two pick is an Irish artist by the name of Louis Le Brocchi. And Louis Le Brocchi does these portraits of poets, of singers, of cultural figures. And he seems to get down to the very bedrock of their consciousness. If I had a house by the sea and a blank wall, and I could have anything on that wall, it would be a Louis Le Brocchi portrait. And I can't imagine anything better than thinking about those characters like Beckett, like Heaney, like Yeats, and watching them side by side with the ebb and flow of the sea. My third pick for the top shelf would be something that's kind of nostalgic. When I was a kid, I remember my father going into the front living room in our house in Dublin, and he would drop the needle down on a record at Christmas time, and I'd watch the stylus move across the record, collecting that little dust, that little sort of hat of dust, as Dylan Thomas boomed out with A Child's Christmas in Wales.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seaturn corner now. Out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep.
It's one of my favourite memories of Christmas, of my late father, of literature itself and how literature can change things. It's a really poetic essay that I could hear really at any time of the year, but I guarantee you that I'm going to listen to it this Christmas morning and next Christmas morning and every Christmas morning thereafter. And sometimes I get my kids to listen to it too. And it sort of shows me the lasting power of stories and storytelling.
I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness. And then I slept.
The writer Colm McCann, whose own painful and exquisite book, 13 Ways of Looking, is just out from Bloomsbury. Well, that's the program for today. Now, tomorrow, Sarah Konoski will be your host, and we'll be hearing about the life and very powerful art of the late Indigenous artist Ngara from the Kimberley in Western Australia, and also the Sydney Theatre Company's production of Orlando, based, of course, on Virginia Woolf's novel about a gender-bending character who lives a very big life. You'll meet Jacqueline McKenzie, who plays Orlando, and the director of the show, Sarah Goods. And then I'll be with you on Friday for Book Club, and this month we're reading a classic and joyful collection of short stories called Malgoodie Days by one of the pioneers of English writing in India, N.K. Narayan. And I'd love to know what you made of it. Please pop along to our website or our Facebook page and leave a comment, and we'll read those out on Friday. The news is next, and then on Earshot, we join Aboriginal artist Jonathan Jones as he travels through Wiradjuri country in southeastern Australia, consulting with elders and doing business with artists as he prepares a groundbreaking exhibition for the Art Gallery of New South Wales. That's Earshot coming up after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Toodaloo.